Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Dolores Handy. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Boston University African American Studies Program titled Forerunner, Edward Brooke, Black Power and White Votes. Our speaker is historian Dr. Jason Sokol. We begin with an introduction by African American Studies Program Director Dr. Linda Haywood.
Today, it gives me great pleasure to introduce a scholar who I met at Harvard when I was a fellow at the Du Bois Center. His name is Jason Sokol, and in fact, he's right here from Massachusetts, from Springfield. He attended Oberlin College and double majored in history and philosophy. Dr. Jason graduated Phi Beta Kappa. I'm a fellow Phi Beta Kappa, so that's good, in 1999 with highest honors in history. From 1997 to 2000, he worked variously for the Springfield Union News, the New Haven Advocate, and The Nation. Dr. Sokol's writings on American history, politics, and race have appeared in those publications, among many others. Dr. Sokol received his doctorate in American history from the University of California, Berkeley, under the supervision of Professor Leon Littwak. His dissertation would become the basis for his book, There Goes My Everything, White Southerners in the Age of Civil Rights, 1945 to 1975, which was published by Ifer Knock in 2006. Dr. Sokol was a visiting assistant professor of history and a Mellon postdoctoral fellow at Cornell University from 2006 to 2008. He then held a Mellon Fellowship at the University of Pennsylvania from 2008 to 2009. In 2010, Dr. Sokol was a resident fellow at Harvard University W.E.B. Du Bois Institute. He is currently a Harvard College Fellow. Dr. Sokol is working on a new book project about politics and race in the cities of the Northeast. Its temporary title is The Northern Mystique, Politics and Race from Boston to Brooklyn, 1960 to 2006. And I'm looking forward to that because I was, in fact, in Brooklyn, living there during some of that time. Dr. Sokol was named one of America's top young historians by the History News Network. Today, Dr. Sokol is going to speak on Forerunner, Edward Brooke, Black Power, and White Votes. Let us welcome Dr. Sokol.
Thank you. Thank you, Linda. This is indeed drawn from my current book project, which is, and Ed Brooke is a central figure of the entire project. He runs through the whole thing, and my stuff on him is near and dear to my heart. I never succumbed to the reality, Brooke reflected some 40 years later. By the reality, he meant the fierce opposition to racial integration that existed in Massachusetts during the 1960s. He meant the riots that exploded across urban America, a rising black power movement, and an aggressive white backlash. Brooke said, "I never let that deter me." Instead, Brooke offered Massachusetts voters an alternate reality, a place where race was no political object, where segregation and racial violence existed on a separate plane from the one where candidates campaigned for a seat in the United States Senate. "I was also asking the voters to rise above that," Brooke recalled. "Rise above that and vote for me." Ed Brooke made for an unlikely Massachusetts senator. He was an Episcopalian and a Republican in a state dominated by Catholics and Democrats. More to the point, 97% of Bay State residents were white, and Ed Brooke was an African American. So in essence, he had a triple whammy going against him. Religion, party politics, and race. Still, in 1962, Brooke won election as the state's attorney general. And 4 years later, in 1966, he was elected as America's first black senator since Reconstruction. He remains to this day the only black senator ever to be reelected in American history. I think a study of Ed Brooke can do a couple of things. One, it tells us a lot about black politics in America, past and present. It makes visible what I think is a largely forgotten historical tradition, which is the history of interracial politics, or more precisely, the history of African Americans who achieve political power on the strength of white votes. Brooke stands as the pioneer of that tradition, and Barack Obama, in many ways, embodies its culmination. So that's number one, and I think Brooke can help to show. Number two, I think he can help us to see the history of race in the North in a new light. In my current project, I argue that a duality lay at the center of Northeastern race relations, that the cities of the Northeast were simultaneously beacons of interracial democracy and strongholds of racial segregation, that they had that sort of dual character to them, and that both stories, seemingly contradictory stories, unfolded at the same time and in the same places. That there were two very real sides to the coin that was African-American life in the North, and that one of those sides, I think, is embodied by Ed Brooke's political success. So that's why I think Brooke is important, the black politics piece and the stuff about the North. As to the first argument about Brooke and the history of black politics, the Obama presidency is 2 years young, yet already several authors have jockeyed over where to place Obama within the broader arc of American history. The biggest of these books, The Bridge by David Remnick, and it's big. I haven't gotten through every word of it myself. It's also big in that people consider it the currently the defining biography of Barack Obama. Inside the book's cover, before you read the book, there is a panoramic photograph spanning two pages, a photograph of John Lewis and famous civil rights activists marching across the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma, Alabama. And the book opens with a quote from John Lewis, quote, "Barack Obama is what comes at the end of that bridge in Selma." So that's how it, before you even get to the biography, that's what you're hit with. Inside the back cover of the book, we have a two-page photograph of Obama's inauguration. So Remnick is positioning President Obama as the clear inheritor of the civil rights movement's legacy. But not only that. In an article in The New Yorker, Remnick also argued that Obama represented something entirely new. In the way that Obama handled America's racial history, particularly in his famous speech in Philadelphia, he signified a rupture with the past. Quote, "Obama posed himself as the break with history, the focal point of a new era, embracing America for all its tribes, for all its historical enmities and possibilities." And so in this specific sense, the Obama presidency ushered in a new era in American racial politics. A break with history, that's what Remnick says. Well, I'm a historian, and historians are suspicious with breaks from history. Even the election of a black president, an event for which there is literally and seemingly no precedent, even that comes from somewhere. In effect, Remnick has thrown down the gauntlet before historians of race and politics. And so our task is to pinpoint which parts of America's political past or African-American past best help to explain this stunning political event. Is the Selma Bridge indeed the most important point of reference? Or does American history carry within it a more illuminating prologue? Two recent books published by historians both look beyond the Selma Bridge. They offer alternate origins, in a sense. The first, Peniel Joseph, Dark Days, Bright Nights, argues that in order to account for the rise of Obama, one must understand the relationship between the Black Power movement and American democracy. That is, how people like Malcolm X and Stokely Carmichael forced openings in American society and political culture that someone in later decades might be able to seize upon. Not Even Past, Thomas Sugrue, contends that to understand Obama's place in American history, one must study the political, racial, and intellectual worlds that he came out of. That is, to examine Hawaii, Harvard, and Chicago from the mid-1970s up until the early 21st century. Sugrue also argues, interestingly, that President Obama has become, quote, the nation's most influential historian of race and civil rights. That is, Obama, the politician, has helped to generate some of the major ways of viewing him within American history, that Obama himself has helped to propound the very notion that Obama is what comes after the Selma Bridge. So that things like Remnick's main argument are actually reflections of intellectual and political devices that Obama has helped to create. So that's how a couple other people are entering into the debate. Then there is the pantheon of American presidential history, where observers have drawn analogies between Obama and Franklin Delano Roosevelt as the Depression-embattled leaders, or Obama and JFK. I don't have an image of all the different hybrids. I wish I did. The presidents who remade the Oval Office with their youthful charisma. Obama and Lyndon Johnson, those who fought unpopular foreign wars while passing landmark social legislation. Obama and Abraham Lincoln, with the common themes of race, overcoming national divides, even their Illinois roots. And finally, Obama and Jimmy Carter, as leaders buffeted by one impossible circumstance after another. As much as these parallels tell us about the problems Obama has encountered in governing, they reveal little about the most crucial dimension, I think, of his rise to power, or about the central challenge he confronts in his quest to keep the American public on his side, namely that he's an African-American leader dependent upon a largely white constituency. So I want to plunge into this ongoing conversation and dip into the past and present you what I think is an alternate historical tradition from which Obama stems. It begins with Ed Brooke in Massachusetts in the 1960s. It could encompass many black mayors who won political office in places with white voting majorities. It could certainly encompass the only two black governors, Douglas Wilder and Deval Patrick. And I think from all of this, we can see that Obama is not a break from history. Neither is he really what comes after the Selma Bridge. He has forerunners in the realm of electoral politics, Ed Brooke prime among them. So the first group of black mayors won election in cities that were witnessing the widespread flight of jobs, white residents, and wealth. These were black mayors and congressmen who basically attained power on the strength of black votes. But when African Americans campaigned outside of the heavily black cities, they had to strike a very delicate balance on the racial issue. Many of them refused to become known as the black candidate, even while they galvanized African-American voters, and even while they encouraged those white liberals who were proud to topple the racial barrier. Many of them mobilized a specific view of American history, often a romanticized or overly hopeful view. They tried to coax into the voting booth the electorate's higher aspirations and its better angels. Now, before I get to the story of how Brooke actually won office in this state that was white, Catholic, and Democrat, here's a quick rundown of his bio, where the major thing I've done here is put Boston University Law School in bold. Brooke first won elective office in 1962 when he became the state's attorney general. His opponent in that general election campaign was Francis Kelly, a man who embodied the stereotype of Boston's Irish Democratic machine. Now, during the campaign, Kelly made hay of the fact that Brooke had a white wife, which he did. In response, Brooke began to turn the racial issue. He insisted that Massachusetts voters were above racism, that they could and they would elect him regardless of his race, and regardless of who he was married to. So Brooke was asserting that the electorate was colorblind. That was part of his strategy to getting elected all these times. But at the same time, Brooke's blackness added resonance to a different argument, and it was an argument about political novelty, where Brooke essentially ran on a platform of change. And if Kelly was the machine-style candidate of the old school, well, Brooke was saying that he was going to clean up the state, raise it above partisan and ethnic divides, transform the prevailing culture of political corruption that was saturating and besmirching Beacon Hill. So Kelly was the old brawler. Brooke presented himself as the agent of change. Everything about Brooke seemed new. He looked like the political future. And this strategy appealed to a specific segment of voters. And it was about generation, geography, and class as much as race. Brooke, in particular, Brooke wooed young World War II veterans and new suburbanites. Many of these voters had long felt under the thumb of Boston's Irish Democrats. The city of Boston had become an embarrassment to many of them. It was known for its corruption and insularity. It had seen much better days. But Brooke offered himself as a vehicle that could whisk the voters away from this dreary present. He played up a lot of anti-corruption work he had done on the Boston Finance Commission and that he would do as Attorney General. And throughout his political career, he would hone variations on this theme. And this younger generation of Massachusetts voters became his core constituents. And there I have a rundown of his statewide elections. He won the 1962 election going away against Kelly, 56 to 44. And Brooke's first term as Attorney General thrust him to the center of a fight over Boston's school system, which was extremely segregated. In February 1964, African Americans drew up plans for a citywide boycott of public schools. The State Commissioner of Education asked Brooke for a ruling on whether the boycott was legal. And Brooke promptly outlawed it. He said it was illegal. Quote, "Boycotts, sit-ins, and demonstrations don't achieve the desired consequences in this commonwealth, he said. On the contrary, they merely intensify the resentment of the population at large and undermine the best interests of the Negro community. If we reject the legal road and use fire and sword, we will confuse those we are trying to persuade. Now, of course, this reasoning presented problems, and it attracted many critics. This is early 1964. Less than a year before, deep below the Mason-Dixon line, Martin Luther King had ruminated on the same question: the legality of direct action protests. And King reached the opposite conclusion. King wrote of those moments in which Americans were compelled to disobey unjust laws, unjust state laws, in favor of a higher law. And of course, this was King's famous letter from Birmingham jail. So if you see Brooks' decision in that context, which isn't entirely the same context because the state laws of Massachusetts were something different than the state laws of Alabama, but I would submit that the general thrust was similar, which is thinking about what African Americans should do when faced with a possible boycott. So Brooke appeared to place himself in a camp that history has treated very harshly, along with those moderate white clergymen in Birmingham. And for this stand, Brooke lost many allies in Boston's civil rights community. "That cat can't help us," said Cornell Eaton, chairman of the Boston Action Group. "He's too involved with the white power structure." And indeed, that sort of criticism would dog Ed Brooke throughout his political career. I had the opportunity to interview Brooke, and I asked him about this. And he said he lost sleep over the boycott decision. "I labored with it. I prayed with it. I did everything I could. And I kept asking myself one basic question: what does the law say about it?" He concluded, "It says that you can't keep children out of school to protest." Now, what does this say? At root, Brooke did not view himself as an activist in the civil rights struggle. "I was not known as a big civil rights leader," he said, "and I never wanted to be a great civil rights leader. I said, you've got them out there, thank God, but I'm not that one." So for Brooke, there was a clear distinction between civil rights and electoral politics, and that to him was a crucial distinction. Look, during his 12 years in the Senate, he became a fighter for civil rights legislation. He still voted with that and was actually very vocal for all sorts of laws that came up, but he was adamant that there was this sort of distinction between the political arena and the civil rights battleground. And many African Americans in Massachusetts, his critics notwithstanding, many did perceive Brooke as an important part of the state's civil rights tradition. But through it all, he maintained a very complex relationship with the black freedom struggle that was rising alongside him. And that was, in a sense, paralleling his whole career. His first run for statewide office was 1960, and he would remain in office until 1978. So that's right at the time that all the other issues are flaring. Moving up to the Senate race of 1966, which we know the outcome of, but there's still drama in there, I promise you. When Brooke campaigned for the Senate in 1966, he downplayed his own race from the outset. And here he was running against former Governor Endicott Chubb Peabody. Brooke told a reporter, "I think I have become colorblind. If all those people, an 800,000 plurality, are colorblind, it's wonderful." Now, Here was an attempt to de-emphasize race in 1966. Okay, 1966 was a time when riots flared in some 40 American cities. Here we have a picture of a riot in Hunters Point, San Francisco. There is the National Guard being called out to Cleveland. And there is police officers in the little town of West Haven, Connecticut, arming themselves for the racial Armageddon. Just to show you that it actually was, these fears were suffusing communities and cities all across the country. But anyway, it was a time when cries for black power mounted and the white backlash grew vicious. And in this atmosphere, the Massachusetts media fretted openly about the potential for racist voters to defeat Brooke. Articles about backlash, frontlash, and indeed counterlash rolled off the presses. They were using these terms all the time in the run-up to the election season. Now there's Peabody. A more combative opponent might have attempted to exploit Brooke's race in this atmosphere. Indeed, one could imagine an Irish Democrat of the old school exploiting Brooke's race. But Peabody was not that man. In fact, he was proud of his own civil rights record, and he was going to fight Brooke for every vote of racial liberals in Massachusetts. In turn, Brooke built a diverse electoral coalition that melded the small Republican base and the small African-American population together with a large number of these white suburban liberals. And that was the sort of Brooke coalition. And, crucially, while Peabody backed Lyndon Johnson on the Vietnam War, essentially took a Democratic Party line, Brooke called for a reassessment of Johnson's bombing policies. And so Brooke was able to add the Bay State's anti-war faction to his political camp and enlarge that coalition that way. Put all of it together, and by August of 1966, Brooke was well ahead in all the polls. He had leads of about 65 to 25 in all the polls, with 10% uncommitted about August or so. But then Stokely Carmichael came to Boston. We know that the image of Carmichael as fire-breathing black nationalist is just one image of the man. He was also a grassroots organizer for whom that kind of image wasn't accurate. But the Carmichael that we need in this talk is that one. Because Carmichael delivered fiery speeches in Roxbury and at Harvard, September of 1966. And almost instantly, white anxiety crested, heightened, with Brooke suffering in the polls. His lead evaporated to just about nothing. The next poll's release said that we were in a dead heat between Brooke and Peabody. Up until that point in his political career, Brooke had always downplayed his own racial identity, or he had even used it to a subtle advantage. Now, all of a sudden, his race seemed to be standing between him and the Senate seat. So Brooke responded with a media blitz. Between October 1st and Election Day, Brooke bought over 3,000 radio and television ads. And in a televised speech, Brooke went on the air and lumped Stokely Carmichael together with segregationist icon Lester Maddox. And he denounced the pair as extremists of black power and white power. Then he turned the screw and said, Brooke said, a vote against me is a vote for Stokely Carmichael. Here was a message aimed straight at the hearts and minds of the fearful white voters, trying to create vast distance between himself and Carmichael. Interestingly, later black politicians who were trying to win white votes would also distance themselves from African-American leaders who were perceived as too radical. In 1989, Douglas Wilder kept Jesse Jackson away from Virginia during the gubernatorial campaign. That same year, David Dinkins was also forced to rebuke Jackson in his campaign for New York City mayor. Most famously, of course, Barack Obama rebuked Jeremiah Wright. And we can talk about how fair these analogies are, but I'll stand my ground on that. I think that all these politicians, in trying to win white votes, would highlight the divides within the black community at pains to prove that a given African-American candidate was not the black candidate. Because that's what Brooke feared at this point. He didn't want to get lumped in with the rest of African-American activists. I will say that this strategy never really succeeded with the white working class. They still voted against Brooke in droves. He always fared worst in South Boston and in Charlestown, in poor white working class towns near the Rhode Island border. Brooke did terribly in all those places. So I'm not sure that the strategy was geared toward winning their votes. It was probably geared more toward the independent and the centrists. Anyway, put it all together, and as Election Day approached in November 1966, speculation mounted about whether Brooke would be felled by the white backlash. And here's the cartoon that appeared in the Boston Sunday Herald on the editorial page above the fold. And it says, innocent victim, with obviously backlash whipped across the back. And the little sign in the bottom right corner that warns it can happen here. Of course, the question mark always haunts me. Innocent victim? If Brooke was defeated at the polls and lashed by racism, was he not an innocent victim? So the Herald cartoon was hinting at this undercurrent, the belief that if the backlash surfaced, Brooke perhaps somehow brought it upon himself. I guess that's what I'll conclude the question mark as meaning. And Brooke never mentioned it in public, but deep down he understood that the larger atmosphere of racial tension in the country and in Boston, the fight over school segregation, provided an unavoidable backdrop for this campaign. He said, you had race riots and everything going on at that time, and here I am, right in the middle of it. I was asking the voters to rise above all that. Brooke was attempting to elevate the election to a higher plane, where pulling the lever for him was a way to rise above it all. He was trying to say that electoral politics could be on a different level from racism and segregation and racial violence. Trying to say that that's all that stuff down there. And that, in fact, he's trying to say that one had little to do with the other. And this was a pitch that helped him to get elected. But it also presented potential problems if he wanted to work for black equality once in office, which I think is something that a lot of his successors would also encounter. This idea of trying to run nominally colorblind campaigns, and then if they want to work for black equality, being questioned on their commitment to colorblindness. So, to get himself out from the middle of it, as Brooke said, and to float above it all, Brooke invoked a specific reading of the American dream. He played on the idea that the whole world was watching Massachusetts, that the Bay State could deliver on America's promise if only it became the first state to elect a black senator by popular vote. Days before the election, Brooke's campaign issued a last-minute press release. It boasted that Brooke had again denounced the advocates of black power and violence. And Brooke highlighted themes of common humanity and the greatness of America. He said, "We are all together citizens of one nation. We are many races and many creeds, brought here by hope or chance, by faith or fear, or by necessity. We have a common responsibility to ourselves and to the world to prove that our way of life is more than a few words inscribed in the Declaration of Independence or on the Statue of Liberty." Brooke was saying that there was one way to breathe life into the claims of America's founding documents. Vote for him on Tuesday, November 8th. Now, Brooke was a politician. Politicians generally trade in platitudes and cliches about hope and progress and democracy and the American dream. But I think that for black candidates appealing to white voters, it was especially vital to prod the electorate's optimistic side into the voting booth. Get them thinking about that stuff when they're making their decision of who to vote for. Move away from themes of racial confrontation, any type of confrontation, and hit the notes of pluralism, American exceptionalism, and all the rest. In 1989, Virginia's Douglas Wilder placed himself in a pantheon that included the Virginia Founding Fathers, George Washington, James Madison, Thomas Jefferson. Wilder urged Virginians to vote for that part of their state's heritage, and not to think about slavery and segregation and all the rest. Also in 1989, incidents of racial violence were permeating New York City. This was the infamous beating of the Central Park jogger. And David Dinkins was running for mayor at the same time. And he tapped into the ways in which many white New Yorkers wanted to perceive their city as a, quote, gorgeous mosaic of ethnicities, races, and cultures. He revived the notion of New York as a tolerant melting pot. In 2006, when Deval Patrick ran for governor of Massachusetts, his campaign manager, David Axelrod, said frankly that Patrick's campaign was premised on, quote, the politics of aspiration. All of these candidates tried to convince white voters that their nation, their states, their cities were special, special enough to write this new chapter in America's racial narrative. And I think that one can't study Obama's political ascent without hearing some of the echoes of his forerunners. Now, as a general rule, while Obama was campaigning in 2008, he attempted to elude the issue of race. But in his speech in Philadelphia, Obama tackled America's racial history in a direct and candid manner. In this respect, it marked a radical departure from the history of black politicians and white votes. But in another sense, the Philadelphia speech represented an apotheosis for the tradition of interracial politics, a model for how black leaders could talk about race to their white constituency. He rested the speech upon a summary of his own American story, as he called it. "I have brothers, sisters, nieces, nephews, uncles and cousins of every race and every hue," he said, "and for as long as I live, I'll never forget that in no other country on earth is my story even possible." That's how Obama opened the whole speech. He would proceed to highlight the errors of Jeremiah Wright, and he also explained to white America the roots of black oppression and black rage. But at the heart of his speech stood messages of hope, racial reconciliation, unity, and with his personal narrative at the center of all that. "Obama's own story," he said, "seared into my genetic makeup, the idea that this nation is more than the sum of its parts, that out of many we are truly one. So here Obama mastered the message that many before him had sought to articulate. He painted the American dream in multiple colors and fused this reading of America's racial history with a hopeful message about the future. And offered himself as living proof of America's exceptional promise, as he would do in Grant Park on November 4th, 2008, after winning the election. Now I have Brooke back up here, so rewind back with me from November 08 to November 66, where similar refrains had pulsed through Ed Brooke's victory speech. Brooke had triumphed with 61% of the vote. In his speech, Brooke declared, "This is the answer the world has been waiting for. It proves that the people of Massachusetts judge you on your merit." The day after the election, the Boston Globe basked in a triumphal version of the state's history. It waxed about the Pilgrims and Daniel Webster and the abolitionists, with Brooke coming at the end of that grand story. Massachusetts elected a black senator and relished its opportunity to spin the tale of racial progress, to retell the story of the city upon a hill. And interestingly, pretty much every newspaper in Massachusetts painted it the same way. You can go to all these different editorials and articles. At the time, many of them argued that Ed Brooke's election was really momentous. A New Hampshire newspaper called it a hallmark in American political history. The Amsterdam News announced, "The sweeping victory of Edward Brooke is topic A across the country." And it endowed Brooke's election with a transformative power. Quote, "The world has moved." The Boston Jewish Advocate agreed. Quote, "It does not take a seer to know that long after such men as Lester Maddox and George Wallace are forgotten, the nation will remember the day that Attorney General Edward W. Brooke was elected." Now, I think from our current vantage point, many Americans remember George Wallace all too well. Few of us, including us Massachusetts natives with PhDs in American history, know much about Edward Brooke's career or his elections. So I ponder, if the event was such a hallmark, and if it so moved the world, why is it so little remembered? One answer has to do with Brooke himself, which is that he staged few dramatic acts in his political career. He compiled a very substantial legislative record, but he did this often quietly and in the background. He was also a moderate in a time of tumult, the late 60s, the early 70s. And he was a liberal Republican at the time of Richard Nixon's Southern Strategy. He doesn't fit in any of these categories through which we often process racially and politically this moment in time. And he doesn't fit into our main stories of civil rights, black power, white backlash. He's none of those things. And I think that this very ambiguity often allowed him to float above controversy at the time and made him attractive, indeed, to many white Massachusetts voters. And it's also left him out of historians' main narratives of black America in the 1960s. And 1970s. Now, what did he actually do while in office? Well, he devoted himself most consistently to the cause of fair housing. Co-sponsored the Fair Housing Act of 1968. Served on the Kerner Commission. You can see him off to the right there. You have Roy Wilkins down on the left, Brooke up on the right, and the rest of the white people on the Kerner Commission. Brooke loudly opposed three of Richard Nixon's Supreme Court nominees because of their racial conservatism, Two of those nominees were defeated. The third was William Rehnquist, who Brooke voted against. Perhaps most significant, Brooke became a vocal defender of school busing. And at a time when almost every elected official in the land was on record as against forced busing, Brooke charted a different course. In December 1974, he denounced an anti-busing amendment. Pounding on his desk in the Senate, one of the few times he was vocal in the Senate, Brooke helped to defeat that amendment. The Chicago Defender called it a stellar performance. In 1975, the junior senator from Delaware, Joseph Biden, tried to tack an anti-busing rider onto another bill. The Senate voted to attach the rider, but Brooke kept debate alive on the larger bill, and it was defeated. Indeed, Newsweek has an article that has a tale of the tape, Ed Brooke, Joe Biden, a sort of mano a mano on the issue. And for all this, Brooke continued to receive strong support from African-American voters in Massachusetts. But many Bay State whites had turned on Brooke in the mid-1970s. I argue, partially because of his stance on busing. And in 1978, he was finally defeated by Paul Tsongas. Still, to fully answer why the only two-term black senator in the history of the U.S., still seems a somewhat forgotten figure, one must also consider the racial history of Massachusetts at this time, and which is that when many people think about Massachusetts and Boston in the 70s, they remember white violence. Nothing more etched in the consciousness like that photo. Boston developed a racist image. And many books have also told this story, this dramatic story, helping to make post-war Massachusetts synonymous with a vicious white racism. And indeed, many scholars these days now stress the racial commonalities between the North and the South. Picturing America as an essentially racist nation pervaded by segregation. But I think such interpretations have a hard time dealing with somebody like Ed Brooke. When he was elected statewide in 1962, 64, 66, and 72, such results were inconceivable across the South. So in racial terms, I think the North should be understood neither as a mythic land of liberty nor as a tale of segregation without relief. That it's best understood as a really conflicted story, a history with Ed Brooke and the Boston busing crisis in it side by side at the same time. So Brooke showed how high an African American could actually rise in Massachusetts. Of course, a social history of blacks in the Bay State told the opposite story. This was often a tale of increasing segregation, of deepening black poverty, solidifying ghettos, seemingly endless battles against white racism. Between 1940 and 1965, Boston's black population increased from 3% to 13%. And as blacks filled up Roxbury, pushed toward other neighborhoods, working-class whites lashed out at the prospect of racial change, well before the fires of the Boston busing crisis. This Boston was the one that came to mind for Celtics star Bill Russell. "I realized in my first year," Russell said, 1956, "this town was basically a racist town and not very subtle about it." The most prominent marker of racial inequality and the most contested was segregation in the schools. This is where, early in 1965, the State Board of Education found 45 Boston schools racially imbalanced and 55 in the state as a whole. In response, the state legislature passed the Racial Imbalance Act, pioneering state law that says you can't have segregation in schools. Yet, the Boston School Committee never lifted a finger. Indeed, Boston would possess even more imbalanced schools by 1971, 71 of them. And when Brooks pollsters conducted surveys of the Massachusetts electorate, they also tracked citizens' views on race and on integration. And one poll, released in September of 66, gave pause to any who believed that support for Brooke might herald larger changes in racial attitudes and practices. This poll found that only 23% of Massachusetts residents approved of the Racial Imbalance Act. 60% disapproved. In the city of Boston, only 13% approved of the law. Remember, the black population of Boston was 13% at the time. Fully 82% disapproved. And support for open housing laws was even weaker. So I think here was the history of the post-war Northeast in miniature. A place where an African American could achieve epic advances in one realm, electoral politics, but where the structures of segregation grew ever more rigid. Thank you.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You have just heard a lecture by historian Dr. Jason Sokol. Dr. Sokol's lecture was titled Forerunner, Edward Brooke, Black Power and White Votes, and was presented by the Boston University African American Studies Program. Tonight's moderator was African American Studies Program Director, Dr. Linda Haywood. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth, with help from Paul Vikas. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Dolores Handy. Thanks for joining us.